Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today is reevaluating the AIDS epidemic. My guest is David Crowe. He is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS and Rethinking AIDS Group, and he hosts a website called RethinkingAIDS.com. He has a background in science, in reporting as a journalist, investigator, and he is also the former president and treasurer of the Green Party in Alberta, Canada. We're going to talk about the war on AIDS. AIDS has impacted so many individuals throughout the world. The question is, after 35 years in this war on AIDS, what have we learned? What are the truths? I've done a lot on the subject of AIDS in my career. In fact, at the very beginning, I opened up my offices for nightly meetings with a group called HEAL and Health Education Alliance. And what they did was they would meet, including some original of the people around ACT UP, a gay organization, and they talked about the different therapies. They discussed the traditional therapy, and which is primarily antibiotics, until AZT came out. And they talked about the role of lifestyle and behavior modification. There would be psychologists talking about why you can't let yourself get into this doom and gloom mode, because if you were told you had HIV, the virus as the cause of AIDS, you were also told that you were going to die. And at that time, death was supposed to be rather quick. So needless to say, anyone getting that diagnosis was thrown into an emotional tailspin. Additionally, we were told that it's just the virus that can cause up to 30 different conditions. But that didn't make a lot of sense. Accepting that the virus could play a role in these conditions, what about other lifestyle factors? And I was actually asked by Dr. Stephen Chiesa, himself a gay male, and he was one of the leading gay physicians in the United States. And we had multiple meetings, and I'd been working with him for 10 years prior to the discovery of the AIDS virus, from the 1970s, 1974 on. So I'd work with a lot of gay men, and these gay men all had something in common. They were living what was known as a fast-track lifestyle, meaning a lot of partying, staying up late at night, not getting a good night's sleep. Some were using drugs. Many had multiple sexual transmitted diseases, and they'd get penicillin and go back at it. And also, some of them were also using some very toxic drugs. And so by getting them to focus upon a very healthy lifestyle and eating lots of fruits and vegetables and a plant-based diet and juicing and taking some herbs in their juices and also getting some medical therapy of homeopathy and vitamin C drips, they were able to reverse these conditions and get back to a normal life as far as their health. And Stephen Kaiser was very impressed with the results that came from this effort. And I even helped Stephen with some of his conditions. And Stephen had the best therapy in America at that time, using an aqueous, meaning water-based vitamin A, to help with syphilis and the spirochetes that can go into the brain and advance to tertiary state and cause the death of a person. So when AIDS came along, I had already seen AIDS before it was officially diagnosed in a small group, probably 2% of the gay population, but I also saw it in a small group, about 2-3% of the heterosexual population, the people living a fast-track life called swingers, multiple sexual partners, unprotected sex, using amyl nitrate or poppers. And once again, by helping them clean up their diets and getting them through their sexually transmitted diseases and getting them to realize sex in and of itself, done properly and protected, does not cause disease, but the way they were doing it certainly was. So I was seeing what we called AIDS in two different groups, but only one of those would be defined, and neither based upon the virus at that time, but based upon lifestyle. So I began to see the emergence of a lot of dogmas. Also, as I had seen in the war on cancer, and the war on mental illness, and the war on heart disease, I had witnessed special interest groups, aligning themselves with pharmaceutical industry groups, in effect, taking over the war. And just like the oncologist working hand in glove with the pharmaceutical industry, were able to actually sell chemotherapy to patients, make a huge profit beyond just what the normal cost of seeing a oncologist would be. I saw the same thing with arthritic sufferers. The doctors were paid by pharmaceutical companies for every patient went on a drug. So I had seen the dark side of medical science, medical practice, and virtually nothing informing the public about the power of lifestyle. And I began to look at the profiteering off the AIDS epidemic, and I wrote several articles, and I did multiple broadcasts, including with many gay journalists, including Charles Ortlieb, Anita Ostrom, and others within the gay community, showing how the whole AIDS movement had been, in effect, hijacked and then taken down one path. And if you weren't on that road with them, you were attacked and vilified. You were called an AIDS denialist. And it got very ugly. And a lot of good journalists, including Sonia Farber among them, their reputations were simply tarnished and destroyed, unfairly so. And so I want to look back now at 35 years to see what is right and what is wrong, what worked and what didn't work. What can we learn when you have a disease and you have a series of diseases and you have an industry that is controlled by certain factions? What is true and what is not? To help us is one of the finest journalists on the subject of AIDS in the world. And he has over 3,000 scientists and physicians and activists who have joined him in focusing on some of the inconsistencies, contradictions, and implausibilities within the war on AIDS. Again, all of the effort is simply to get people who have been diagnosed with AIDS, get them healthy. My interest is get them healthy in the best way they can. And so that's my effort. I've worked with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS, and help many of them reverse the disease completely, including going from HIV positive, HIV negative, from near death to vital health. And that was fully documented. Let's go over to David Crowe. David, there were many promises in the past. There was the belief that by now modern science would have eradicated the disease. There were promises for vaccines to protect people, and other kinds of preventative technologies or diagnostic tools were promised and predicted. How did they fare, and how accurate do you feel that your earlier insights were, and then share the difference of what we were told was going to happen and what actually happened? And also today, I was doing a report, and it showed that where AIDS disease is 75th, there's 74 other diseases that are more prominent in front of AIDS, it got the dominant amount of research money. So I believe it's over $800 billion has been spent. So explain to us how we're still funding this at that level. What promises were accurate, which were inaccurate? The form is yours.
Well, I think budgeting for HIV research in the United States is pretty easy. David Rasnick, a colleague of Peter Duesberg and a PhD in, I think, chemistry, has tracked the funding, and you basically take last year's number and add $1 billion, and that's this year's funding. So it increases at a particular level every year. It's just a routine. As you mentioned, vaccines, and back in 1984, they said there'll probably be a vaccine in 2 years. We're now out in 2019. There's been no vaccines, and it's very difficult to understand how there could be a vaccine because the HIV test is based on antibodies. So if you have antibodies to a virus, that normally means you have immunity. So somehow they have to create antibodies that provide immunity because they say that the natural HIV antibodies do not. And then they have to be able to tell the difference between those two things. And they're still not really at square one. Now with drugs, they have been kind of playing a clever game. It's very important in modern drug research that you eliminate the placebo. They said that the first AZT trial was done with a placebo, but investigations of people like John Lauritsen and Lynn Gannett showed that the trial was heavily corrupted. But once you have a drug approved for, say, AIDS or anything else, then it's considered unethical to test the next drug against a true placebo. So you test, DDI would be tested against AZT, DDI being the second drug that I think came out in 1991, AZT in 1987. And so that means that if the second drug is maybe a little bit less toxic, that's good. If it's, they normally measure what they call surrogate markers, so they measure the effect on CD4 cell counts and on viral load and things like that. They don't actually measure the impact on health. But over time, the HIV drugs, the AIDS drugs, have definitely become less toxic, so people are living longer. So it's like you're giving people a lower and lower dose of poison, and you're saying, look, our drugs are working because people are living longer. But they would never do a test of, let's take somebody who shows up with AIDS. They've been, say, using drugs, whether it's poppers, which was prevalent in amongst fast-track gay men, or if they're injecting heroin, or they're inhaling cocaine. You compare, put them on AIDS drugs versus try to get them off the recreational drugs. What would be the results? There have been some experiences, like I've interviewed a Spanish man, Raul, who in the mid-1990s was having basically heart failure due to an extremely bad injection drug habit. And he had one of those come-to-God moments on the operating table. And after he got off the operating table, he not only decided never to take never to inject drugs again, but he completely changed his lifestyle, his diet, and everything about his lifestyle. I think that was 96, and he was discovered to be HIV positive, not exactly at that time, but a couple of years later. He never took AIDS drugs, and he is now still perfectly healthy. For his age, he's far healthier than most people. But what if he had stuck with his heroin habit and gone on ARVs? He probably wouldn't have lasted another year. So I would say the success of the drugs, if you read the labels of the drugs, they all have devastating lists of side effects. But, of course, nobody reads the actual label that comes with the drugs. They just trust their doctor that this one is better than the last one you were on.
Take us further. Take us into the studies and show us the studies that show that they have been on the wrong track for a long time. It's one thing to say that AIDS doesn't exist. That would be a denial. But for all of us, everyone that I know, in the scientific community, the journalist community, the medical community, we agree that AIDS-defining illnesses are real. The question then is, are we diagnosing it properly and accurately, and are we treating it in the best possible manner? That's where the argument should be focused. And tell us about what it means to be labeled as an AIDS denier by a small group within the community, and the media takes it on, and Wikipedia takes it on, even though there's no truth to it.
Well, we can sort of work backwards. The media is mostly people who didn't study science. If they did study science, they haven't in the past. They really aren't keeping up because they're journalists, and that's fine. But what they tend to do is they go with the status. So if somebody's earning $1 million a year as the head of an important AIDS institute, you assume that what comes out of their mouth is the gospel truth. And if somebody like Peter Duisberg is, described as all kinds of, insults online about a washed-up former scientist, whatever, then the journalists don't want to listen to somebody like that. It's dangerous. It's dangerous to their career. If you, for example, publish, take Peter Duisberg's argument seriously, and you also maybe interview Tony Fauci or Robert Gallo, and you decide as a journalist that Peter Duisberg's making a lot more sense, you could lose your journalistic career. That's happened to people like Neville Hodgkinson at the Sunday Times in the United Kingdom, and Joan Shenton's career, and Celia Farber's journalistic career. It's it's not a good a career move for a journalist to take these questions seriously. I'm afraid I forgot the first part of your question.
That's all right. I'm going to ask you some questions and tell me your research and the scientists that are part of your group, and I believe you have close to 3,000 medical doctors, scientists, and journalists who all now are challenging the corruption within the AIDS paradigm. They're not denying AIDS, but they're saying it's being completely monopolized by profiteers, and they've, much like cancer, heart disease, mental illness, there's people who get in there, the pharmaceutical companies get in there, and they control the whole outcome. So let's start with first that we were told absolutely positively that AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease. That's how you spread HIV. What does your research show?
Well, there was some really good research done by a group led by a man named Gieselquist that showed a lot of anomalies, especially in Africa. One of the anomalies in Africa is that women are more likely to be HIV positive than men. Yet if you take any measure of promiscuity, men register higher, with the exception of prostitutes, of course. Prostitutes will have more sexual partners than even most men. Prostitutes are not a risk group for AIDS. So if AIDS was sexually transmitted, prostitutes would not be a risk group, would be a very big risk group. Now, prostitutes are somewhat a risk group in the United States, but there's a strong correlation between drug use and prostitution, because prostitution is essentially an economic problem. Women go into it because there seems to be no other way to earn money, and it's strongly correlated with drug addicts in the United States who resort to prostitution to feed their habit. But in other countries, say in India, prostitution is more related to your class, to your economic circumstances. And there, despite predictions, prostitution is not a risk for HIV transmission or AIDS. So the sexual transmission has basically been debunked, but it's so widely accepted amongst the mainstream scientists that they won't even examine their own data. There was a good paper by a guy named Pettifor a few years ago, and he found something like a 20% rate of HIV positivity amongst young black women, a very low rate amongst young white men and women, and about something like a 6% rate among young black men. So why was it so much higher amongst young black women than among men? There was really no attempt to answer this question. They also found a fairly high rate, about half that rate, you know, maybe 10% among women and 3% among black men, amongst virgins. And they solved that problem by saying, well, obviously those people are lying about their sexual history, but maybe they weren't lying. Maybe people have antibodies against the. Maybe people test positive on the HIV antibody test for other reasons. Another member of the board of Rethinking AIDS, Dr. Henry Bauer, a former dean of science at Virginia Tech and a chemistry professor, his evaluation is that blacks are genetically more likely to test positive on the HIV test. It doesn't mean they have a virus. It's an antibody test. So there's something that produces more false positive amongst black people and maybe more amongst women than men. But this is misinterpreted that there's going to be this holocaust of deaths. And as Peter has pointed out, the population of Africa is growing. And all of the predictions of massive, you know, population crashes in Africa have proved to be absolutely false. The problem with the population in Africa, if there is a problem, is that it's growing faster than the economies can handle.
Now, we were told that the only test necessary would be the antibody test, the ELISA and the Western blot for confirmation. Explain who owns the patent on this, and then why is that test showing so many false positives?
Well, I guess the very usage of the test shows that false positives are a problem. In most Western countries, they start by doing a single ELISA or EIA test, which is a very simplistic antibody test. And if you test positive, they do two more, and then they take two out of three. Now, this is not really very sophisticated. Like, if you're having false positives, you know, the chances of you creating a false positive with an algorithm of two out of three is actually statistically pretty high. But they're not even finished with that. So then they say, well, you got two out of three ELISA tests positive, so now let's go to the Western blot. The Western blot is different than the ELISA test because the antibodies are separated, or the antigens are separated, to produce reactions with each protein. But if all of these proteins are part of HIV, you should react to all of them. But in fact, if you only react to one of the proteins, they will probably say, well, you know, that was a false positive reaction to one protein, so you're probably negative. But if you can have false positive reactions to one protein, why not two or three? Like, how do you determine that there's a magic number that if you have three protein reactions to what's believed to be HIV proteins, then you're HIV infected? And if you only have one or two, you're not. It doesn't really make any sense. And then they will say that there's no false positives to Western blot because they don't have a confirmatory test. If they had yet another test, they would run that test, and sometimes it would be negative, and they say, oh, that was a false positive Western blot. But conveniently, if you don't have a confirmatory test, you have to assume that every test result is a true positive. And there's no reason to believe that's the case. And we haven't even got into viral load yet, which is not a diagnostic test, but is often used as if it was.
As a follow-up to what you just answered, is it not the case that if you have had the measles, the flu vaccine, if you've had hepatitis or herpes or tuberculosis, if you've had over 75 different medical conditions, you could also test positive, which means that the HIV antibody test is not a gold standard test?
Well, actually, Christine Johnson, who put that list together, her last research got it over 100 reasons for false positive, and interestingly, one of them is having been pregnant more than once. You know, pregnancy is obviously impacts your immune system because you have this foreign object in your body that you have to make sure your body doesn't reject. So women have unique immunological circumstances that men, until we can have men having babies, men don't experience. But yes, there's many reasons for false positive antibody tests. And also there's bias built into the system. For example, they have what they call test algorithms, which is, I outlined it simply before, but it's a little bit more complicated. So you do the first ELISA, then you do two more, you take two out of three, then you go do the Western blot. But what if one of the ELISAs is it's just a color change. So what if it's close to positive, but it's not quite? So then the algorithm says, well, if this person is at risk, then you do some additional tests. So you actually do the testing differently. So what does at risk mean? Well, it might mean that you're a gay man, it might mean you're an IV drug user, or it might be that you're the lover of a man who's been accused of of trying to transmit HIV sexually. And so that might increase the chances of you testing positive and therefore would increase the criminal punishment of the HIV-positive man, usually a man, sometimes a woman, who has had sex with other people without protection.
During the past 40 years, we have been seeing infection rates and cases of AIDS globally, even before it was called AIDS. And we were told that AIDS is a death sentence. If you have the HIV virus, you're going to end up with AIDS, and then you're going to die unless you go on a drug treatment program such as AZT originally. So discuss how that has actually borne out.
Well, I know some people. I think my best example is a hemophiliac man who was diagnosed in either 87 or 88. He was very young at the time. He doesn't remember exactly when. his parents decided not to put him on AZT, which was the only drug at that time. When he came of age, he continued with that decision, despite the fact that every year he'd go see his doctors and they'd say, you know, you're going to die if you don't go on these drugs. What he saw was all his fellow hemophiliacs dying, and he remained healthy. And he's still healthy today, and not for a single day has he taken AIDS drugs. And I've come across many stories like that. One of the websites I run is livingwithouthivdrugs.com. There are many stories of people who have experienced excellent health by not taking the ARVs. In some cases, an HIV-positive test has been a lifestyle wake-up, because I don't think an HIV test, an antibody test, is completely without meaning. It may mean that you have a high level of antibodies in your body, so it could be that there's some issue with your lifestyle. So if you're doing drugs, or you have a bad diet, or you're living under a lot of stress, or you're exposed to toxic chemicals, it might make sense to change your lifestyle. But it doesn't appear to make sense to take antiretroviral drugs. At least if you read the labels of the drugs, I think you probably would not take them.
Are we finding any more recent studies that are disrupting the belief in a direct relationship between the infection, the symptoms that we call AIDS, including showing that if people have what is known as a high viral load, they should absolutely go on the antiretrovirals, and that's their argument. Tell us about what you know and science shows about the viral load.
Well, there was a study, I think it's maybe 10 years ago now, that showed that there was no correlation between viral load and CD4 counts. So CD4 counts are supposedly the immune cells that are infected and killed by HIV. So the theory goes that if you have AIDS, your CD4 count will go down and down and down until it's zero and you die. On the other hand, viral load reflects, supposedly, the amount of virus in your body. And therefore, if it goes up and up, it means you have more virus and there's going to be more damage. This study found that there was really no correlation between those two things. People ask me, well, what does a low CD4 count mean? Well, there's a lot of literature that says that there are healthy people who have virtually zero CD4 counts, so it doesn't appear to mean that your immune system is compromised. And we also know that exercise makes your CD4 counts go down, and that should be a bad thing. And cigarette smoking makes them go up, which could mean that cigarette smoking is good for you. Somebody tried to correlate viral load to the amount of virus that they were counting using cell culture, and I think there was a 60,000-fold difference. In other words, viral load was overestimating the amount of virus counted by cell culture by a factor of 60,000. So you get these huge numbers, you know, viral load is a million. It scares the heck out of the patient. If you're told your CD4 count is 200 and 500 is good, that also scares the patient. So they're very effective at getting people on drugs. But the actual evidence that they're meaningful markers of health is limited.
I'd like for you to talk about the letter that you and dozens of other scientists and activists and physicians signed to Science Magazine, the publication that originally brought forth Robert Gallo's articles, where you asked them to rescind those articles and you never heard back. Who were some of the scientists and what were their reputations and their background where they were so committed they were willing to go on the record and hence face vilification themselves and condemnation because they said the original article by Gallo was flawed?
Yeah, so David Balick, PhD, McMaster University, Department of Surgery, Henry Bauer, Dean Emeritus of Arts and Science at Virginia Tech, André Pierre Benquerel, PhD, Professor Emeritus, University of British Columbia, Darren Brown, a PhD in Mathematics, Harvey Biley, PhD, Founding Scientific Editor of Nature of Biotechnology, Gordon Burns, a PhD and professor of cancer research, in Australia. Roberto Giraldo, who sadly just passed away, an MD, specialist in internal medicine. Charles Geschechter, professor emeritus of history. Etienne de Harvin, professor emeritus, I think, of virology and electron microscopy at the University of Toronto. I don't know if Peter signed this, but he's definitely one of our most prestigious members. Gordon Stewart, emeritus professor of public health at the University of Glasgow and a consultant to the National Health Service, to the World Health Organization. So I could go on and on, but we had a very prestigious list of signatories to this letter, and we didn't even get the courtesy of a reply to the letter, which was sent on December 1st, 2008, which is not only World AIDS Day, but that's the year that they finally awarded the Nobel Prize to Luc Montagnier and not to Robert Gallo.
Explain what was the challenge. What did you and the scientists find was wrong with Gallo's original paper that established the entire war on AIDS?
Well, Robert Gallo published four papers in the journal Science, which is a very well-connected American scientific journal, politically connected. And there was a lot of information came out due to investigations by John Dingell, who, this is history, John Dingell recently passed away. He did a big investigation and produced a staff report, but when Newt Gingrich took over Congress, probably just out of spite, he canceled all of the research that the Democrats were doing. I don't think Newt Gingrich really cared one way or the other about the research, but anything the Democrats had done, of course, he was going to destroy. However, those papers became public through research of people like John Crutzen and others. Letters came public that showed that they hadn't really found the virus. For example, Dr. Gonda, head of electron microscopy at the National Cancer Institute, wrote to Gallo and said, "I do not believe that any of the particles photographed by Gallo are of HTLV-1, 2, or 3. Now, you have to remember that HTLV-3 is what we could now call HIV. And he had explanations for what was there, but it was not the virus. A day before Gallo submitted to Science, he said, "It's extremely rare to find fresh cells from AIDS patients with the virus. So, cell culture seems to be necessary to induce the virus." So the letter had a list of the flaws in Gallo's original research and was calling for a retraction of what is seriously flawed science, upon which the whole foundation is based. And I think Peter said this, that if you have a 300-story skyscraper with a rotten basement, you know, when the basement crumbles, the whole skyscraper goes down. And that's probably the problem. They don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole, because if they seriously consider flaws in Gallo's research, the whole edifice, the very profitable edifice of HIV-AIDS collapses.
Go back to the person who was the head of Gallo's laboratory at the National Cancer Institute, who wrote the paper, and then Gallo came back, I believe it was from France, where he was trying to talk people up about his HIV antibody test, and how Gallo took a pencil and scratched through all of the important statements and rewrote it. And the reason we know this is because Janine Roberts, a wonderful award-winning investigative journalist, one of the best women journalists in history, she's the one who brought us Blood Diamonds and Aboriginal children in Australia being taken into schools and losing their identity, all these great stories, she found that, and she brought it forward. I saw it. Tell us about what was the basis for this challenge and what was wrong in Gallo's original article in Science magazine.
Yeah, so what Popovich did was that he took some of his papers and he sent them to his sister, I believe, in the Czech Republic or somewhere like this, because he knew that fraudulent things were happening. And when things got hot and there was an investigation. He wanted to protect himself. And so he had all these papers, and one of them was a copy of a draft, one of the papers going to the journal Science, and Popovich had written, "Despite intensive research efforts, the causative agent of AIDS has not yet been identified." Gallo scratched that out and wrote that a retrovirus of the HDLV family might be an etiological agent of AIDS was suggested by the findings. Now, the HDLV family is Gallo's personal family of viruses, HDLV 1, 2, and 3. And he said that HDLV 3 was HIV, what we now call HIV. And etiological just means causative. So Gallo said, "We found that one of my HDLV viruses causes AIDS, or at least was suggested by the findings." It was only later that people kind of pushed and pushed until they basically said it's been proven HIV causes AIDS, but even Gallo didn't quite go that far. But there was really no reason for this. There wasn't enough time for Gallo to have come along with some other research that would override his laboratory chief. And one could imagine that an important scientist like Gallo is spending more time at conferences and, you know, meeting to try to get funding and things like that. And the guy who's in the lab every day would be Popovich. This is quite different than Peter Duisberg's lab, where Peter's in the lab actually doing real research pretty much every day.
But was it not also Popovich sent over the samples and the head, the director of the National Cancer Institute's electron microscopic division, sent back the letter that you have a copy of? I have a copy of it. I've seen it. And it says, tell the public, this is so important. The journalists should be ashamed that they never looked at this.
Right. So Dr. Matthew Gonder, head of the electron microscope laboratory at the National Cancer Institute, said it said somewhere in the letter that Dr. Gallo wanted these micrographs for publication because they contain HDLV. He then says, "I do not believe any of the particles photographed are of HDLV 1, 2, or 3. He said that one sample contained cellular debris, while another had no particles that were even the right size of a retrovirus. But this was 4 days prior to publication of Gallo's article. But 4 days later, Gallo published with micrographs and described them as HDLV 3, or HIV.
And what has your and other scientists' research shown was the reality of those original photographs? Were they actual photographs of the HIV virus?
Well, they were photographs. In 1997, in the March issue of the journal Virology, there were two papers published where they took what had been called previously purified virus, so cultured, filtered, centrifuged to get just the virus particles. They put it under an electron microscope for the first time. This is 1997, so we're now talking 13 years after the 1984 press conference. And they said at least 90% of what we're looking at is impurities. The problem with that is if you analyze a sample that's 90% impurities and you find some proteins or you find some RNA, how do you know that it's from the particles that you believe are the virus? You have to get close to 100% purity before you can analyze the materials. But I'm unaware of any more pure samples than that. It's just like people didn't want to believe that they were not dealing with pure HIV, and so they just ignored these papers in the Journal of Virology, which is a prestigious journal.
Finally, what does this tell you about the scientific editors, the scientific community, and leading members of the AIDS community looking at the same material or having the opportunity to see the same articles and the same discrepancies as you have laid out and as 3,000 other activist scientists with very prestigious backgrounds, including two who are Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, and they're finding these discrepancies, and yet not a single member of the American media, not one single person, has been willing to look at the same data and challenge the pain, profit, and politics of the war on AIDS?
There are stronger and stronger parallels with a religion. You know, if the Pope makes a strong statement about something, that's what religious, you know, Catholics would say is the truth. If the Pope doesn't say anything, then maybe a cardinal can say something. And if cardinals don't say anything, a bishop. If the bishops don't have a position, then a priest gets to say something. But the journalists wait for one of the high priests of HIV and AIDS to speak. And if there are heretics, just as there are in religions, you know, a Catholic newspaper is unlikely to publish an analysis of, you know, a Pope statement written by a heretic. They are disappeared. I mean, that's what they've tried to do with Peter and so many of the other scientists who've bravely continued to say, no, I'm not going to agree to this false hypothesis because there are just too many things wrong with it, and I have too much self-respect to just bow down because of money. But the fact is that most journalists and most scientists don't have that much self-respect, and they easily get pushed into saying what is the politically correct thing, what is beneficial for their personal career, rather than really digging into the dirt and discovering the cesspool of corrupt funding and corrupt research that is HIV/AIDS and some other areas of science as well.
How many people do you now have on your list? And I have published their statements on our website. So if you want to see what all these outstanding scientists and journalists, including AIDS journalists, AIDS physicians, gay physicians and gay journalists have to say, and they themselves have been ostracized, they have been attacked from inside the community because they would not, the AIDS community would not allow any dissent. So if you dissented on any point of view, even if you accepted many of their points of view, if you dissented at all, you were now suddenly labeled as an AIDS denialist.
Yes, we have close to 3,000 people. Everybody on that list has some kind of credentials, so a scientist or an MD or a journalist or politicians, you know, people who we would look up to say, you know, these are the kind of people that we should listen to. On the other side, I mean, if people say the right things, then it doesn't matter what their educational background is, what their research background is. They just get taken seriously because they maybe represent drug-using community or the gay community, and they say, we need more drugs. And if you say that, they don't ask too many hard questions about, you know, should we take this person seriously? And so we have 3,000 people that we're very proud of, who have come out publicly and said that there's something wrong, something terribly wrong with the HIV/AIDS hypothesis.
I remember, I'll just take a little extra time, and I apologize to the next show, but I feel this needs to be said. Back in the early 1970s, I was approached by a highly respected, multi-award-winning journalist. His name was Pat McGrady, Jr. He was the bureau chief for Newsweek in Moscow. And he said, Gary, and I had never met with him, he said, could I treat you to a lunch because I have something to tell you? And I said, why me? He's because you're not afraid to go after the truth, and all the other journalists I have spoken to won't touch this. Why won't they touch it? If it's a good story, he said, because it would be a career ending, and you don't seem to care whether your career ends or not. You go after. I listened to you on the radio. Have for a long time. So I said, what is the story? And Patrick said, the entire war on cancer is a fraud. Cancer's real. People get it. People get treated. And people, some survive. But if they do survive, 100% of the credit's given to the therapy. Never once is anything that the patient might have done. Maybe they changed their lifestyle. Maybe they completely changed how they were dealing with stress, etc. It's all the treatment. He said, my father is one of the leaders of the American Cancer Society. He heads and has for decades their public relations department, and he finally had one of those come to Jesus moments where he said, "I can't do this anymore. We're taking in lots of money, and we have rights on patents of drugs." He said, "But we're not helping people, and the whole AIDS establishment is just a fraud." That's what he told me. I didn't know whether he was right or wrong. I asked him for the proof. I met with his father. And his father was a very soft-spoken man. And I said, "Give me some proof." And he did. And one of the things he gave me was a booklet from the American Cancer Society. It was called The Unproven Methods of Cancer Management List. It was a book that contained every therapy that was not orthodox. For example, there was Dr. Emmanuel Revisi, Dr. Virginia Livingston Wheeler, Dr. Joseph Issels, Dr. Lawrence Burton, Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski. There were all these names. So to get into the book, you had to have a number of things that they would check off. You're not a real medical doctor. You're not a real PhD. You have not published in peer-reviewed journals. You have not been a recipient of government grants in your field. You have not presented your information before respected scientific bodies. You make promises of cures. You charge a lot of money. So if they got a certain number of these, then you were in the book. So he made an introduction to the person that actually headed that. And I sat down with him and I said, "I've done some research on all the people here." And this took me about 6 months. And I said, "Could you please tell me, let's take one of these people. Let's take Dr. Lawrence Burton. Show me how he ended up in your book." And he just said, "Well, he makes promises." I said, "But wasn't it the American Cancer Society, your organization, that invited him to and a Dr. Friedman to present their treatment, and he did it in front of a whole group of journalists where they reversed ascites tumors in rats in a matter of hours? And wasn't that work done at St. Vincent's Hospital under Dr. Tino? And hasn't he gotten all these grants? Isn't he a legitimate PhD? Hasn't he published dozens of papers? He doesn't charge money for it. Where has he gone wrong that he ends up in your book?" And he couldn't answer it. In fact, of the six people that I mentioned, he couldn't mention one single thing about any of them. He had never interviewed them. He had never read their papers. He had never interviewed their patients. It was just he was given a list, meaning they were the heretics. What you're talking about, David, with, if you challenge anything about age, you're suddenly the heretic of this religion.
Mm-hmm.
That led me to see that from the very top, it was all biased. I then got to meet the director of the National Cancer Institute, and he told me, and also one of the top founders, Dr. Dean Burke, told me that they had wonderful results in treating cancer with vitamin A and vitamin C. But when chemotherapy came along, all those were put to the side because they weren't making any money. And then the National Cancer Advisory Board, these are the people that advise the president and Congress where the money goes. All the money was being sent to their own institutions. So here are very prestigious people, heads of university, heads of pharmaceutical companies. They were having the American public fund their own organizations. And that really set up a flag, and then I said, "Yeah, we have a story." So I then went about spending a year, and with a close friend and an outstanding journalist, Bob Houston, whose sister is Jean Houston, in her own right, outstanding spiritual feminist, we went to work and we published an article, and nobody would touch it. Mind you, I'm talking about an article that challenged the establishment that we had lawyers review all the material. It was 100% accurate. Mother Jones wouldn't touch it. Harper's, Atlantic, East Village Other, Ms. Magazine. No one would touch it. And I asked, and one of the managing editor of Mother Jones says, "Gary, your material's spot on. It's accurate. My uncle is one of the people who was attacked. But I can't touch this. We'll lose all of our advertising." And finally, it was in a East Side New York Manhattan, Our Town was the publication, and we published it there. It won the Audie Award for Best Investigative Journalism, and then nobody would come forward. And it was only one publisher who had the courage to say, do you believe that alternative therapies that could help people are being suppressed? I said, yes, sir, there are. He said, we're going to publish it. You had to see in the room. His lawyer said, no, don't publish it. We'll get sued. His advertiser said, we'll lose $7 to $8 million in advertising. His publicist says, you'll be attacked. 18 people in that room all said thumbs down on the article. And he had a very quiet voice. And he leaned across to me. He says, do you really think we can save some lives? I said, sir, we'll save a lot of lives. He said, we're going to publish it. The room just went in an uproar, angry. And in fact, when we went out on, as I was leaving the brownstone over on 67th Street, the managing editor came up to me, and he's punching me in the chest with his finger, saying, this will never appear in my magazine. And I looked at him, I said, sir, this is not your magazine. This is the publisher's magazine, and yes, it will appear. I ended up having 12 articles exposing the corruption in science and in medicine published in that publication, 58 cover stories over a 26-year relationship, including 7 on AIDS. Not once did the publisher back down. He was simply the most courageous publisher I'd ever dealt with in my life, and he became a friend, too. So I'm looking at what happened in cancer. I also saw the same thing in heart disease. I saw the same thing in mental health. And once again, you have one of those outstandingly honest men, Dr. Peter Bregan, a board-certified psychiatrist, neurologist, and one-time advisor of the National Institutes of Health. And he said that all these diagnoses in mental health, they're all fraudulent. All these treatments for kids, giving them drugs, they're fraudulent. And they went after him. So it's not just AIDS. It's any area of medicine or public health that you would challenge, you're going to get attacked. All of them act like religions, not just AIDS. All of them have their advocates. All of them have people at the end of the trough getting fed. There is no accountability of anything, of anyone, no matter how wrong they are. In fact, I'll finish this up and let you give your final comments. We did a series of articles called Death by Medicine. It took 5 years for 4 of us. I was a PhD, all the rest were MDs, and many were MDs and also professors. And we looked at Orthodox Medicine's own figures that show that the number one cause of death in America, nearly a million people, was American medicine. Iatrogenesis, the number one cause of illness, or number one cause of injury. So death was more than cancer or heart disease or stroke, and nobody acknowledged it. No one did anything about it because it's a $3.4 trillion a year industry. People are making a lot of money. No one's going to allow change. No one's going to allow any controversy. And so nothing changes. We published it. Nothing happened. We're just updating all those figures and those stories right now as we speak. I have another report tomorrow on this. Nothing will happen. So when I see this, for my long career in public health, I've seen that the fact that we report on the truth, show the corruption, show the conflict of interest, show the politics and the profiteering, doesn't mean that tomorrow someone will stand up and say, oh yeah, let's go in and do some research on that. It just never happens. Your final thoughts?
Well, I agree that in many areas of medicine, it's really the same thing. Anywhere where they say it's black and white, especially where it's quite clear that the establishment is not having a great deal of success. So we could talk about mental illness. You talked about cancer. We could talk about vaccines. The press and the well-funded scientists are all on the one side. Everything's good. Send us more money. We'll create more mental illness drugs, will create more vaccines, will create more chemotherapies, will create more AIDS drugs. And it's all based on money. If the money stopped, those paradigms would collapse overnight, because I don't think anybody really believes in them. But when you're making a 6- or 7-figure salary from a scientific theory, you don't care if it's true or not. It's profitable.
Well, I appreciate all the work that you're doing and all the scientists. And no one is denying AIDS. No one's denying the seriousness. No one's denying the pain. No one's denying the psychological impact, the physical impact. It's just that we believe that we should take the profit and the politics and the ideology out of it so that other scientists, other public health officials can come in and make a difference. After all, in 15 years of working with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS at the Tri-State Healing Center, we didn't have a single one die, and we reversed the condition in 8 people, and they appeared on Tony Brown's Journal on PBS, and they were vetted completely, and we did a press conference. We did a whole 12-hour whole demonstration with these people coming up and giving their own testimony with their medical doctors. And none of that was ever reported in the media. And it's not because the media didn't know. They chose not to report that. That's how much pressure was brought upon them by the pharmaceutical industry or special interest who didn't want another point of view on AIDS to come forward. So good for you, David. So David Crowe, and David has a program on the Progressive Radio Network, and we look forward to another conversation with him. So I want to thank David Crowe for being on. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.